Hello, I'm Alan Kohler, Editor-in-Chief of Eureka Report, and joining me in the Money Cafe remotely today is Marcus Padley, who has the daily stock market newsletter Marcus Today and also runs an equity investment fund. Has been a stockbroker for a long time, but now you only do you don't stockbroke anymore, do you, Marcus?
No, I don't. 39 years was enough, Alan. That was it. Yes, I was a stockbroker in the UK for 16 years talking to institutions and then came over here, did it for a short while and then ended up in retail stockbroking. But the newsletter overtook the broking in the end. And for the last 5 years or so, I haven't been a broker.
And that's because it was a very fine newsletter. And in fact, I've known you ever since you started it, I think, or very soon after you started it, 20 years ago, more than 20 years ago. Is that right?
Yes, I seem to remember we were on the, was it called the Insiders program on the ABC?
Yeah, business, Inside Business.
Inside Business, that's right.
Yeah, that's
inside
right.
Inside Business, goodness. And that was a while ago, 2003 yeah. or something?
Every Sunday morning.
Every Sunday morning. Not every yeah. Sunday morning. Every Sunday morning for you, but... and Tom Elliott was there, but Tom went off to the dark side. He's still there, I believe.
So well, he's doing, Tom's doing very well. He's,
yes, he is, yes.
But unfortunately, his father's just passed away. Did you see that?
Yes, I saw that, yes.
Very good. Well, look, we've got plenty to talk about. And can I just say, can we just start with housing, Marcus, because APRA has just come out with its the beginning, I presume, of its macro, what they call macro-prudential policies, which is that it's going to increase the buffer, which is the amount that banks have to add to the interest rate the borrowers have to pay as they when they calculate whether the borrower can afford to service it. So they used to have to add 2.5% to the interest rate, and now it's 3%. Do you think this will make any difference whatsoever?
Well, what I read was that this is going to reduce the average loan for a geared person, reduce the average loan by about 5%. So, yes, it does. But I think it's passing a message, not necessarily the serviceability buffer itself, but it's passing a message that Josh Frydenberg, I think, was talking about a couple of weeks ago, wasn't he, that they are getting concerned at the regulatory level about the level of household debt versus income. And how everyone's chasing, obviously, what has been a hot property market in the last year. Do you remember the economists at the beginning of the pandemic talking about this was going to cause a 20% drop in the housing market? And it did exactly the opposite, the pandemic, yeah, especially in Melbourne.
I do remember that, of course. It was...
It was everybody deciding, particularly down the peninsula. I've seen houses up 50% in the peninsula. I know the... numbers don't say that, but in Melbourne, it was the obvious spot for people to go and spend their lockdown period, and they're thinking of staying there permanently. So everyone's chasing this housing market.
Oh, the reason I ask whether it's going to make any difference is because I saw a thing from Commonwealth Bank yesterday, the economist department at Commonwealth Bank, saying that only 8% of borrowers actually borrow to the maximum that the bank will lend them. 92% of borrowers have room left. So it looks to me like the increase in the buffer will only affect 8% of borrowers.
Well, that may be so, Alan. We are so beyond that. I think if we were my daughter, who's 25 and looking for the first time at housing and whether to buy a house or not, we would have a completely different attitude to what APRA is doing, because APRA is effectively ringing the bell on house prices a little bit, and that's scary. I worry about my daughter. What's she supposed to do? In order to live anywhere near us, she's going to have to borrow at least $1 million, if not more, and take a bet on the housing market never having a correction. Otherwise, she'll be working the rest of her life to pay the Commonwealth Bank the equity she lost in her house. It's scary stuff for younger people. For people who are our age, Alan, 50, 38, who don't have this big mortgage pressure, this is fine. But for the geared people, that 5% or so, who are desperately trying to do what the previous generation did, this is It must be scary stuff entering the property market at the moment, because it's just become unaffordable. I remember in London, it became unaffordable. And the house, my brother and I bought our first house, I think £80,000, and did it up, sold it for £120,000. And things went on like that. And we saw London become unaffordable, which is what's happening in Melbourne now, become unaffordable, but it didn't stop. It just kept going.
I was going to say, London's just become more and more unaffordable, hasn't it?
Absolutely. My brother's £600,000 house from 20 years ago is worth a couple of million pounds now. And who could buy it off him? Is there a miraculous 0.5% of people who can fund and repay? Repaying a mortgage is so 1980s, I've got to say. But no one, the average wage in Australia cannot afford the average house and the interest payments and repay capital at the same time. At some point, that sort of equation you think has to break, but we've been waiting for that for 40 years. It hasn't happened.
Yeah, hence the concern among the authorities about the debt-to-income ratio, which has gone from 2 or 3 times to 6 times. I think that's the house to income ratio, actually, the 2 to 3 times income to 6 times income.
Well, I've noticed in the stock in the market, Alan, you might have seen over the last couple of days, I think there have been 3 brokers who have put out effectively downgrades on the CBA. CBA are the most exposed to the housing market. And this is also the classic time for brokers to do that wonderful recommendation, which is sell your CBA, who don't have results coming up, and buy Westpac, NAB, and the ANZ, who have results and dividends coming up. And this housing market thing's perfectly timed for that recommendation.
Does this happen all the time with brokers, though?
Every year it's a rotation. You see, the banks are the biggest holdings that most people have, including the institutions, because they're the biggest weighted stocks in the market. And to get people to roll their CBA into the other banks and then out of those banks back into CBA and pick up these dividends every 6 months. And this is the beautiful thing about the bank sector, is that the year end of CBA is 3 months out of kilter with the year end of all the other major banks. So you get this ability to pick up the CBA dividend, sell them by the other banks, pick up their dividend, sell them by CBA. It's one of the most classic broker calls.
But does that work for people? Is that a good thing to do if you're an investor?
I've done a lot of work on stripping dividends, and effectively, no, it doesn't. Hence, it's really just a fabulous way to generate an idea that gets commissioned for brokers. But I've done a load of work on stripping dividends, and effectively, no, it doesn't work, because the share price goes ex-dividend and the share price drops by the amount of the dividend, often with a bank by much more, because people have anticipated the dividend, they bought it for the dividend, they sell afterwards. And the golden rule of dividend stripping is, if you wouldn't buy the stock, irrelevant of the dividend, if you wouldn't buy the stock, don't try and strip the dividend, because you need a share price to be trending up to carry that trade. Otherwise, it's a nil-sum game.
Is there a tax benefit? You get the franking of the dividend and then you get the capital loss?
No, well, that's a folly. I think, yes, you get a capital loss. And this is – now you're dealing in nths of a percent rather than significant percentages that are going to make a difference to you. One of the biggest follies, I think, of Australia, that I was staggered when I came here that people do it, is this – obsession with trying to pick up franking. And I know the financial planning industry is obsessed with it, because what a lot of financial planners do is that they tell their clients that what they're going to achieve for them is to collect franking credits. And what some of them do is that they will effectively refund with the right documentation, they will refund the franking credit to the client, having stuck them into too many banks so that they could do this. They refund the franking credit, and they take their fees out on the way. So effectively, it's all above board. There's nothing wrong with it. It's an agreement. But they take their fees out, and in that way, the financial plan doesn't look like they cost anything. So there is this there is this underlying feeling that financial planners need to attract or need to achieve a franking credit refund check for their clients. That corrals clients into the banks, and it corrals clients into basically low growth, mature companies that haven't got anything better to do than return the money to shareholders. It's completely different to the US culture, which is bonds are for income, although they're not really anymore, and equities are for growth. It's why Berkshire Hathaway's not paid a dividend for decades, and Microsoft, because they see equities for growth, and paying a dividend is a failure because it means I can't do anything better with the money than hand it back to you. That's why the US culture, I think, is so much more geared to equity success rather than, in Australia, income, which is a bit of a nil-sum game.
Just back to the banks and the sell, leaving aside the sort of switch, the brokers trying to get commission by switching people out of CPA and into the others, do you think that the banks are potentially a sell now because of APRA cracking down on the lending?
No, not really. That's APRA's all just part of the cycle. The banks are a very boring, long-term, but very stable Australian stocks that will, I think, continue to suit a purpose for a lot of retirees, in particular who are after income. They continue to be a stable platform on which to earn income well above bond yields. And you'd need something far more disturbing than short-term APRA change in regulations, because in 6 months' time, you'll be talking about APRA relieving the regulations again. These are longer-term stocks for most people. So I don't think that'll top it out. And this is something I've always known as a broker, that you'll see a major broker put a sell recommendation. If a major broker ever puts a sell recommendation on a big bank, you know they're just trying to generate commission, because 6 months later they'll disturb the whole retiree investor base into thinking, oh, goodness, this big broker thinks it's a sell, it must be a sell. And they sell, they take their capital gains, and then 6 months later that broker will have a buy. So I think investors have to choose their own time frame, and it's a broker is always going to have a shorter time frame than an investor.
So just more broadly on the market, you had an amusing piece in the in Livewire the other day about signs of the top. So before we get into the signs, do you think we're approaching a top in the market?
I don't think we're approaching a precipitous top. Every 10 years or so, we have a precipitous sort of moment, be that a global financial crisis or be that the pandemic. We seem to have a significant correction once every 10 years or so. Not that it's going to go on that cycle, but you can see they're rare.
And by significant, you mean 30% plus?
Yes, 30 to 50%. But we have probably once every 3 years, we have a routine correction, which would be 10 to 15%. And I think we're obviously due one of those because prices are high. The US market goes up around 8%, just over 8% per annum plus dividends. And in the last 18 months, since the bottom of the pandemic, the S&P 500's gone up 107%. But since the top, pre-pandemic top, so ignore the pandemic, since the pre-pandemic high, it's up about 35% and against a usual 8%. So we've done, quadruple, five times the normal 5.85. I'll get that number wrong. But we've done 4 to 5 times the usual annual return in the last 18 months. We're due a bit of a sell-off. But as I look through the reasons for why we might have a sell-off, they're all routine stuff, tapering. We all know about it. An economic slowdown, debt ceiling always gets solved, infrastructure bill, it'll happen. Prices are high, interest rates might go up a tiny, weeny little bit. There are all these, iron ore price was fairly significant, tax increase in the year. All these are routine. The only one I can see that could be precipitous would be the Evergrande situation, which appears to be containable if the Chinese authorities chose to contain it. But you don't know. You've got to keep a look over your shoulder at that one. But all the others are routine. And routine sell-offs don't get very scary. You know, 10 to 15%. The NASDAQ's already 7% off the top. So
aren't you worried about inflation?
No. The most of the inflation concerns, you'll see the LNG price overnight has dropped 10% or something as Putin opens up his gas pipeline. This is not an endemic inflation problem. It's a energy driven supply chain problem, which is emanating in, or what's the word? It's filtering out into inflation in a lot of places, but it doesn't seem to be endemic, and it's hard to imagine that coming that post pandemic that prices are anything more than, as the Fed says, transitory, because of supply chain issues, and as the economies open up, it'll dissipate. So I wouldn't be worrying too much about inflation.
I suppose the thing about the inflation that we're seeing at the moment, because as you say, it's generated by supply problems, in particular in energy, but elsewhere as well, is that the reason inflation is bad for equities and shares is because of interest rates going up. And the thing is that interest rates have no effect on supply. I mean, interest rates going up. I mean, everyone thinks interest rates are going to go up, but they won't. The central banks aren't going to cause a recession in order to control inflation that's caused by supply problems.
No, they are definitely not. I don't think interest rates are a concern. You and I, Alan, I've still got a letter in a drawer here somewhere where the TSB Bank in the UK informed me that my mortgage rate was going from 14.1% to 15.5%. Yeah, we haven't got high interest rates. Anyone who has geared themselves so much so that they are going to get concerned about a 1% rise in interest rates is a fool, as far as I can see. We are at extremely low interest rates. Clearly in Australia, they're not going anywhere. They've told us if they told us once, they've told us five times now, the RBA, that interest rates are going nowhere for till 2024 at least. You know, this is not a time to be worrying about interest rates.
They have been wrong, let's face it.
True. But I think we're still in a world of small numbers on interest rates, and it does stagger me, the obsession of the market with interest rates so low to be poring over every adjective that a central bank pops out to try and determine whether we're going to see a 0.25% rise in the next. Who cares?
It's something to do, Marcus.
I think you'd be better off, trying to find out whether there's one stock that might go up by 1% in the next year, rather than worrying about whether interest rates are going up. It's just the market needs to explain every movement in every stock, in every market, every day, because investors hate uncertainty. They feel happier when they've had everything explained. It's a failing. We don't have to explain everything all the time.
So what are the signs of the top, Marcus?
Signs of the top. Well, I think the most obvious one to me, I put this question out to our members, show us the signs of the top, because I remember in 2007, there were three stockbrokers that listed. Stockbrokers never list. They're terrible investments, because the principals in a stockbroking firm know the industry cyclical. They distribute all the profits in bonuses and salaries before it gets to a shareholder. Who'd ever be a shareholder in a stockbroking firm? And here we go, three of them listed in 2007. So I look back on the GFC and go, yeah, that was a sign of the top. I also remember working for Patterson's, and they put their name on Subiaco Oval, Patterson Stadium. Stockbroker putting their name on a stadium, they're signs of the top. So what are the signs of the top at the moment? I think the obvious ones to me is space tourism. Richard Branson and Bezos in his, excuse my language, blue penis disappearing into the space. is that not a sign of the top? There are too many billionaires around. That would be an obvious one. And then of course, you've got Bitcoin, Dogecoin, all the other coins. I mean, this only happens when the market's, you know, happy to take ridiculous risks. That would be one. Non-fungible tokens. you know, there's a...
You're just showing your age, Marcus.
It's ridiculous. Come on. This only happens when people have got stupid money. And so all these predators appear. There's a horse race that races digital non-fungible token horses for real money, and you're supposed to buy a horse, and they can change hands for the same price as a luxury car. I mean, what rubbish! So these are all signs of the top. I saw there was an AFR article as well about some chap giving up his had a lovely photo of some chap who'd put a clock on his back wall above his PC, a clock of Sydney, Shanghai, New York and London. And here he was, 30 years old, giving up his job. I hope his wife with two kids is happy about it, so he could trade currencies. For goodness sake, everyone's a genius when there's... So these are signs of the top, but more realistic signs of the top are that Buffett indicator, which I hate using Buffett for in any context, but the GDP, US GDP versus the GDP of the versus the market cap of the S&P 500 is higher than it's been since the tech boom. You look at the PE of the S&P 500, 21 times, the long-term average 16.5, that's 20% above normal. You look at the long-term trading range, even on a, not that lines on a chart mean anything, but even on a log chart, and the S&P 500 has popped right out of the trading range. There are a lot of signs that we're due a sobering, not, it doesn't have to be disastrous, but just a bit of a sober up as far as price is concerned.
In the light of that, are there any stocks worth buying, Marcus?
I think the obvious trade, which has already started, but stocks that I think have to come back are travel stocks. We are all of us, I think.
They've already come back a fair way.
No, not very much. If you have a look, they're still well below the pre-pandemic highs. And in terms of recovery potential, especially in an overpriced market, in terms of recovery potential, they are the... reasonably obvious play. I can't help thinking that Qantas will be sitting in a boardroom in 5 years' time and go, wow, that pandemic was the best thing that ever happened to us because it wiped out the competition and stuck prices up. But Qantas will still be around. And there aren't that many in Australia, travel stocks. So I think that's a good little stable. One of the stocks I tried to persuade the guy that writes our trading section that I have crucified myself on 1,000 times and probably will crucify myself with this utterance as well, is AGL. Just noticed there are three brokers who recently taken off their sell recommendations. It started to, I look at relative charts, it started to, it stopped underperforming for a while. That could be why I'm a sucker for stocks that have fallen a lot, which is always a mistake technically.
Sometimes they deserve to fall, Marcus.
No, absolutely, Alan. And we've done it before in the fund where we've bought a stock and that's in downtrend and bottoms and bought it and the fundamentals look great. And then a month later, you're going, why did we buy that? It was going down. And the other obvious one is the iron ore stocks. And I am just waiting for the moment that the iron ore price bottoms, because I know there are downgrades coming, but Fortescue's on a PE of 4.9 and BHP 6.7, and they've got yields of 16% and 23%. You know, there's something wrong there. Either the forecasts are all too high or the share prices have to go up. So I think there's probably a combination of both.
We better move on to questions, Marcus.
Yes, absolutely.
We've got a few. Jay says, hi, Alan. Great to have you back on the pod. As a Marcus Today member, this bloke, Jay.
Pay attention, Marcus.
He's one of your members.
He's a quality man, obviously.
Quality man, discerning fellow, but he's getting stuck into you, Marcus.
Oh, God, here we go. If there's anything nasty, I don't want to hear it. I'm really over social media.
This is, as you say, a quality person. He says, I'm interested to hear you question Marcus Padley over his heel dragging on Bitcoin. Is dissuading investors from certain sectors doing them a disservice? Especially poignant, considering Bitcoin's consistent year-on-year growth and influence that Marcus holds. You are definitely dragging your heels on Bitcoin. You think the whole thing's a joke.
I'm happy to drag my heels on Bitcoin because I don't see any sort of integrity to it. It is a bit of a generational thing, it has to be said. Us slightly older, more sensible people are not very sensible when it comes to new things, and we don't bother to research them properly. It doesn't fit the pattern of what we have been used to in terms of assessing value. It also requires an enormous amount of trust, and the people who present themselves as Bitcoin or any sort of cryptocurrency operator at the moment are all predators. If you look on the website or the spam emails you get, it's all about the predators dive in on anything that moves a lot and present it as easy and something that everyone else is succeeding at. Of course, it's utter rubbish. If I can't predict where the Bitcoin price is going, then it is just gambling. And I have zero interest in gambling. If you were to see Bitcoin come 13% off the top in a night and you could explain exactly why, fine, let's go and invest in Bitcoin. But it's not investment. If you can't explain it, it's a massive herd charging around. The only way you could possibly, as far as I know, and I could well be wrong, write me off. Take no notice of me because I'm a skeptic. But
there you are, Jay. So the answer, Jay, is that Marcus doesn't know what he's talking about.
Absolutely. I have not spent the time, and I can't see the integrity, predictability, value of it, in which case to me it's just a gamble and there are predators everywhere.
Okay, John says, last week Carlos asked a question about how emissions trading works, and following Emma's answer, I still don't understand the main thing. Question, how does the trading of emissions credits make any difference at all to the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere? Do you know, Marcus?
No, not my field, Alan. I would just say this, Alan. I look intensively at stocks all day, and my audience is mostly looking after people who are looking after their own money. It does stagger me in the media that we are expected to be, and this I'm not making any comment about the questioner, but it does stagger me that we should be put on a pedestal of all knowledge about everything financial. You know, what would I know about emissions trading? I'm looking at whether to buy BHP or Flight Centre.
You know, yes, well, look,
it's not my area.
Okay, well, these companies that you mentioned and many others are buying emissions credits.
Yep.
Emissions credits are generated by people either cutting their emissions below what the government determines is their baseline or their kind of allowed an amount of emissions, or by doing something that reduces emissions in the atmosphere, like planting trees. And so that generates emissions credits. And the reason that the trading actually helps to reduce the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere is that people can buy these credits. And by pushing up the price, it makes people want to reduce their emissions to generate credits so they can sell them to other people who can use them to offset their own emissions. So there's a thing going on where people are reducing their emissions or planting trees and inventing carbon capture and storage, for example, that would reduce emissions, and that generates the credits. And that kind of this market, this trading, actually does reduce CO2 in the atmosphere by encouraging people to generate credits that can be sold to make money. So look, I mean, I think it's relatively simple.
Oh, Dad, what I have seen in the market and can notice is that just bear with me on this little tangent, but apartheid, what got rid of apartheid was somebody in the US, non-official, got hold of a list of companies dealing with South Africa and highlighted them. And suddenly people didn't want to work for those companies, trade with those companies, deal with those companies. So those companies started to have to react to apartheid and say there's something wrong. And things changed. In the same way, you'll notice in the last few months, since their announcement of merging their assets with Woodside, so it's only really been in the last few months that BHP has started advertising its ESG credentials. And this is why ESG will work, is because suddenly corporates have identified that it is going to affect their bottom line if they can't get this right. And BHP, astonishingly, you would have thought the last company that would have ESG credentials, is trying to lead on ESG. And the dollar has finally caught, or ESG has finally caught up with the dollar. And hence, this change is now beginning to happen. And prior to that, if it didn't affect them, they wouldn't have taken note. But they realized it's in their interests. And so things are starting to change. So it's not really regulation, politics. It's commercial impact. And ESG is starting to have a commercial impact. It's quite clear. Otherwise, BHP wouldn't be doing it.
Final question from Ian. I think this is really for you, Marcus. What is a sensible buffer to have before exercising options? If the options have a year to run, cash would be no more of an issue than is as now. I have options in two companies trading between 5 and 10% above the strike price. Do you have a view on that?
I don't quite, without prepping, quite get where he's going. But what I would say is options are there, you know, they are quite easy to price. I'm pretty sure. I mean, I could do you an Excel spreadsheet on the Black-Scholes model and price your options. Options will be under or overpriced, and I would assess. I would have to assess on the parameter. I can't say anything about the price or otherwise of his options without knowing the details and parameters. And all that,
so. You can't. So the answer, Ian, is it depends.
Well, no, it has to be, doesn't it? Because it's based on a movable price, and I don't know the volatility of the companies involved, but there is a way to price them. You could probably just Google options calculator, put in what parameters you've got, and see whether they're over or underpriced. But be careful, don't leave it to the last minute, because anything with a time value just cascades in the last couple of months, and you'll find yourself caught out. So you have to make decisions early on company options.
Well, Marcus, it's been great having you on in the Money Cafe. It's been fascinating. And as always, you've got plenty to say and you're frank. So it's been great. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thanks very much for having me, Alan.
And thanks to you out there for listening to today's episode of Money Cafe. Send in a question and we'll answer it next week. Email us on themoneycafe@eurekareport.com.au. Until next week, I'm Alan Kohler, Editor-in-Chief at Eureka Report. And he's Marcus Padley. Marcus Padley,
today.
Marcus Today Marcus newsletter.
Marcus Today newsletter.
Come on. What's the name of your funds, by the way?
It's the Marcus Today SMA.
Very good. Thanks, Marcus, and talk to everyone soon.